From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Letson. It's May, and in schools across the country, students are getting restless. Classes are coming to an end, and the promise of summer seems just within reach. But I want to take you back to a beginning of another school.
Good morning. Good morning, PM students.
It's September 2014. Barack Obama is president, and it's just a few weeks after a white police officer killed Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri. On the west side of Chicago, fourth graders at William Penn Elementary have the first day of school on their minds. They're filing into an auditorium to hear from their mayor, Rahm Emanuel, who's touting rising test scores.
Yes, give the teachers a hand for what they've accomplished.
The head of the public schools at the time, Barbara Bird Bennett, is here too, to tell kids a version of something that poor children all over the country hear constantly.
No matter where you're from, what neighborhood you call home, and no matter what your dreams are in life, it is right here at Penn that our children are going to get their start so that they can have that dream, chase that dream, capture that dream, and live it.
It's a big idea that is at the core of our nation's identity. It doesn't matter who you are or where you're born, you can make it. And school is where that happens. These fourth graders are all sitting near the front. They live in the North Lawndale neighborhood of Chicago, one of the poorest neighborhoods in the country. It's filled with vacant lots and boarded up buildings, not many jobs.
All of Chicago believes in you. There's no subject too hard for you to learn. There's no dream you can't achieve if you stay focused and persistent.
If you stay focused and persistent. And with that, she makes it clear, it's up to the fourth graders and every kid in the auditorium to work hard and succeed. It's up to them and William Penn Elementary. The school bell rings, then the principal hits play on the sound system.
Thank you so much. Class is in.
The mayor and the TV cameras pack up and the school year begins, with everyone hoping that William Penn can be the antidote to poverty. That's what schools are supposed to be, the great equalizer, except too often, they're not. And lately, when schools don't make it, drastic things happen. In Lawndale, two-thirds of the schools have either been closed or turned into charter schools, or seen their entire staff replaced, from the principal to the lunch ladies. To find out what life is like under that kind of pressure, education reporter Linda Lutton of WBEZ Chicago spent the 2014 school year reporting on a fourth grade classroom at Penn. Today, we're playing a condensed version of her Peabody Award nominated documentary, The View from Room 205.
I know it's gonna be fun, and it might be a little challenging.
If anybody's gonna take the mayor and the school's chief at their word and dream and be persistent, it's the fourth graders in room 205.
Do you think you can meet that challenge?
Yes!
Okay.
If you haven't been around fourth graders recently, let me remind you how great they are. They're still curious and fun, happy to please their teachers. They get excited about simple things, like chocolate pudding for lunch.
The first thing we're going to do this morning is, what do you know about fourth grade?
The room starts to buzz. Their teacher, Ms. Carolyn Hathorne, moves from group to group. If you saw Ms. Hathorne in the supermarket, you might actually guess she's a school teacher. She wears turtlenecks and teacher sweaters and sturdy shoes.
I know that fourth grade is not going to be easy. I know that we are going to have to take a test. I know that I might not pass. Whoops, wrote that wrong.
They present their work to the class, and Ms. Hathorne oohs and ahs them.
I love it.
Makes them feel proud.
I'm delighted. I think I'm gonna like this year. I really do think I'm gonna like this year.
Next, Ms. Hathorne turns to the test, not the one they took last year.
That's gone away. For good. Well, thank you.
Lord, thank you, says one of the fourth graders, as if God himself had struck down the old standardized test.
Please listen. If that one went away, there's a new test. And I heard someone say,
park.
She writes park on the board, but she doesn't have to. The kids all know about it, even though it's brand new. And they all know the other big standardized test, too, which they'll take three times this year. Think about this for a minute. The kids in room 205 are only about an hour into fourth grade. Instead of imagining science experiments, art projects, field trips, what they're looking ahead to are the standardized exams. And that's not unusual. This is the norm at high-poverty schools like Penn, because the tests, they're how we measure a school's success. It's how we decide if all the reforms we're trying are working. In middle-class schools, where kids score well, the tests feel like an afterthought. But in high-poverty schools like Penn, they are center stage.
We're going to have to read a lot. We're going to have to write a lot. And math is very challenging, but I do believe you can do it.
I do believe you can do it. But as Ms. Hathorn looks out at her brand new fourth graders, 30 kids look back at her. And try to imagine this, please. 23 of them are boys. She has the son of a former gang leader in class, wonders what that will be like. There's the boy who's depressed, on medication, age 9. Several children have parents in jail or recently released.
I don't know. I don't know if I'm doing something right or something very bad, and God is trying to tell me.
Still, so much about room 205 feels optimistic. Take Jamarie. He's like the classroom IT guy. Ms. Hathorn calls him her little computer man.
He keeps over there on the computer just like a little man working.
When she can't get a projector to work or the fourth graders have trouble logging on in the computer lab, Jamarie gets the call.
So you ever put the password in on the tablets?
No. You know what the problem is? Just finding the time to get
Jamarie's a little chunky. He has a head full of dreadlocks. He looks like he could somehow be your uncle, even though he's only 9. He loves anything electronic. His current obsession is an obscure video game called Mugen.
What I'm working on right now with Mugen, I'm trying to make a character. I made my own stages and my own title screen, and I made my own music for it, too.
Jamarie's mom is positive he'll be a game designer when he grows up, a software engineer, something. I liked thinking of what all the fourth graders might be. Chelsea, for instance, a little girl with an outsized laugh. She's always organizing something in room 205.
Give her a little snap.
She's fun, bold, opinionated, maybe a future activist.
It's time for reward.
At recess, I'd let the fourth graders play with my radio equipment.
Hey, y'all. Kelsey.
They'd pretend to be reporters, celebrities, all live on air from room 205.
Kelsey, what did you see about the hurricane last night?
I didn't see the hurricane, but shout out to my mama. I love you and I miss you, and I hope you bring my big old remote control car.
Kelsey's got an ear-to-ear smile and a backpack bigger than he is. Just about every time Kelsey got near my tape recorder, he'd give a shout out to his mom. I thought his shout-outs were like any other kid's shout-outs until I found out he only sees her on Fridays. He's a foster kid, and my microphone, Kelsey saw it as a way to connect with her. Penn is Kelsey's third school in 3 years. His first was shut down. He changed again after he got put in a foster home, but he's relentlessly positive. Here's what I mean. Kelsey, how was your day?
It was a great day.
Really? What made it so great?
Because we are doing math and reading.
Nothing special, even. Great is just Kelsey's baseline. When you talk to kids like Kelsey, or so many of the kids in room 205, you feel like, yeah, it is so possible to overcome poverty by sheer positivity, by smarts, by curiosity. I started going to class as often as I could.
We will be a good. Tell us that you want us. We won't be annoyed.
Write your name. We're working on 3 new prefixes. Un plus happy equals unhappy, and it means
not happy. Kelsey's working with a partner, and he's doing a little dance right by his desk, which he does unconsciously almost all the time.
Kelsey, think.
I'm thinking.
Non-fail, disfail, disobey, that don't make sense.
Many of the words they're supposed to modify with their new prefixes are words they don't know, words that neither school nor life along 16th Street has taught them. like the word ripe.
The only example I can come up with is bananas.
Ms. Hathorn comes over. This is the second group she's helping with the definition of ripe.
Ripe bananas are yellow.
I can't think of a store along 16th Street that sells fruit.
The bananas that are green
are ripe.
What would you say about them if they're not yellow?
I would say
they're not all the way grown.
Kelsey and his friend lean over a dictionary.
Yeah, right there.
Adjective. Fully grown and developed.
Fully grown. Right, unripe.
I want to paint you a picture of the neighborhood where the kids in room 205 live. If you want a shorthand way to think about it, I'd say imagine TV footage you've seen of Detroit or Baltimore or the worst parts of New Orleans a few years after Hurricane Katrina. North Lawndale's Katrina has been a decades-long storm of disinvestment, slow and thorough. One day, I ran into Kelsey outside, right by Penn. He was with his brother, and we were talking for a while before I realized the conversation kept coming back to the same place.
You got candy?
I'm sorry.
I had a lot of chips today. I don't want no more chips. I had hot chips.
You full?
No, I ain't full.
Since there was no school this day, there was also no school breakfast or lunch. A guy from a social service agency happened to pass by, coming out of Penn. He tossed each of the boys a little bag of chips. Kelsey's brother finished his own, then started eyeing Kelsey's.
I can get some.
I just gave you some.
I can get two.
Thank you.
Are you hungry, Colton?
Yeah.
You are? What did you eat today?
We ate none. We ate chips, and that's all.
Well, plus your breakfast, right?
Yeah, breakfast. We didn't eat breakfast because we went outside.
It's almost 5 p.m.
And we didn't ask for breakfast anyway. We got to ask before we get.
Kelsey looks at me.
Do y'all kids got to ask before they get?
I'm hungry. My stomach growling.
Let's hear it. Let's see if I can hear it with this. Turn it way up.
I put my microphone right up next to Kelton's tummy, and I give him my headphones so he can hear. And just as I do, a car drives by, which sounds like a big growl in the headphones.
It is. Hey, Miss Linda, you hear me?
Sometimes it felt like there just wasn't enough food in Lawndale. There's been an increase in people living on $2 a day or less in this country. Lawndale is one of the places they live. Homes that stay dark after the sun goes down, not enough for the light bill. People go to friends' houses to bathe when the gas is cut off. There are more shuttered businesses than open ones along 16th Street, most everything behind bars or bulletproof glass.
This is my cousin's house. That's the dog.
I really wanted to see these games Jamarie was always talking about, all the characters he was building. At his apartment, I wasn't sure if we'd be looking at a laptop or a desktop, but I had not considered this, his mom's cell phone.
I can get it to turn on.
So we're looking at a LG cracked screen.
Yes, I dropped it.
Turns out, room 205's IT guy, little computer man, has no computer at home. Later in the school year, I notice an article in the newspaper about Minecraft summer camps. Of course, I thought of Jamarie. The story was about how frantic parents were pleading to pay extra tuition, thousands of dollars sometimes, to secure spots for their kids in the camps. In Lawndale, the per capita income is $12,000 a year. That's close to the amount affluent parents spend on each of their children just for enrichment, musical instruments, tutoring for standardized tests, Minecraft camp.
It's a really nice game.
Ms. Hathorn may be headed towards 70 and retirement, but she still has a way with the fourth graders.
What do you always tell me?
Hey, favorite teacher.
And do me in.
Ms. Hathorn is considered a pro at Penn. She trained the principal. But she's also an old school teacher. Her own training took place in the late 1960s. Back then, Chicago assigned black students to infamous temporary classrooms, specifically to avoid integration. So Ms. Hathorn's very first classroom wasn't even technically in a school. It was on the first floor of a housing project. She was assigned a mentor to help her become the best teacher possible.
The first time she came, you could tell she was nervous because she had to go by the gang boys to get back there. So while she was in there, there was a fire.
It was on an upper floor of the projects. And at one point, a mattress full of flames came crashing to the ground, fell right by the classroom door. That was enough for her mentor teacher.
That lady, she says, Carolyn, would you walk me out to the car?
She never came back.
I had to do a journal so that she could track what I was doing.
And that was Ms. Hathorn's preparation as a teacher. The segregation and racism of the city baked right into her training. Few of the conditions she teaches in have changed. It's Ms. Hathorn's normal. Concentrated poverty, segregated schools, a bombed-out neighborhood. In Lawndale, a lot of things are normal that shouldn't be. As soon as I found out about the killing, I went to see Chelsea, the fourth grader with the outsized laugh. Her cousin Caprice was 16. On the funeral program, he has a baby face. He's floating in a blue, cloud-filled sky, light from the heavens all around. He was shot on the same block as Penn. I found Chelsea outside. She was just back from the funeral.
He got shot 2 times in the head and 3 times in the chest.
This has become the way Chelsea explains what happened, the refrain of her cousin's killing. The funeral was open casket.
He had a whole bunch of makeup on. Because the bullet holes, they couldn't cover it up. So they had to put a whole bunch of makeup on him. And then he was over dark, like this.
Chelsea taps on my black car.
When you rub your finger like that, the makeup came off. And it showed a little piece of the bullet hole. Because everybody kissed him on his forehead.
Chelsea's big voice and her confidence make it easy to forget that she's just 10 years old. And she's one of the older kids out here. I feel like I've stumbled into a mini impromptu memorial, one just attended by children.
I feel bad because she died.
The thing about kids, they don't really follow adult rules for talking about death. And even while they're grieving, they're still little kids debating what makes a good block party. Answer, a bouncy house. And how to best eat pickles.
Put the pickle juice with your hot chips. A sour pickle juice. Ooh, they don't make your chips hot and sour.
I like Kool-Aid pickles when they cold and icy.
Chelsea's clutching the funeral program. Occasionally, a kid tries to snatch it. They want to see it.
Get it.
Is that the first person you've known who was ever shot?
Chelsea looks at me, puzzled almost, like, of course Caprice is not the first person I've known to be shot.
I remember everything. I remember my Uncle Ken got shot. My Uncle Ken got shot when I was 5. I had another cousin named Will. I grew up with him. He helped my mama take care of me when my daddy was in jail. And so he got shot when I was 7. He had got shot in the head 3 times. And Caprice got shot 2 times.
That's the kind of trauma these kids are carrying with them every day, whether they're on the playground, at home, or in room 205. We'll hear more in a minute on Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX.